The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We call this the Empowerment Hour because my goal is that every hour, 15 hours of live broadcasting a week, that we give at least 50 different points of empowerment, meaning things you would not have known that are important. For example, today I'll be doing a commentary from David Michael Green from regressiveantidote.com about what has happened to our society, about how we make decisions. And I think it's very insightful, and I think that we can be motivated and inspired by it. I'll also be talking about our veterans being given deadly cocktails to treat post-traumatic stress disorder, and the results of those drugs they're given frequently will cause suicidal tendencies. And also, is your life worth more to your government than a few dollars? Gain in oil stocks. We're going to be sharing with you today from Joanne Harry of Huffington Post how Tony Blair, working as an emissary, in effect, for British Oil, was able to negotiate deals with the Libyan dictator Gaddafi in order to get British Petroleum really good drilling rights in his country. In return, he wanted the Lockerbie terrorist return. He got what he wanted, British Petroleum got what they wanted, and they tried to put some lipstick on this pig. We'll take you behind the scenes because we have some exclusive documents to prove that Tony Blair was not working on behalf of the British citizens or the people of Scotland, but British Petroleum. More power to British Petroleum, less to the world. And all that with the latest on health and nutrition. However, so you're going to get a lot of good information today. But we're going to continue at the top of our show with my guest from last week. We're going to talk with Dr. Dyer, who has once again made himself available, which we're very appreciative of. And just so you remember, I will give a new introduction because of people who tune on for the first time and wouldn't know what we're discussing. I wanted to do a program about pending geopolitics of global warming, such as food shortages, mass migration, and even military conflicts, things that are not in the average person's mindset, but nonetheless are very important. Now, Dr. Dyer is a Canadian historian. He also is a graduate in military and Middle Eastern history from King's College in London. He is a scholar, and he's taught war studies at the Royal Military Academy in the United Kingdom. He's also the author of War, which was the basis of a PBS and BBC television series. And his most recent book is Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats, and which is being really held by James Lovelock, who we've on this show, and Dennis Bushnell, NASA's chief scientist, and others, is a very important work. We got through some issues, but today I want to give more time to get through more. So let us go now to my guest who's standing by and talk with him about some other things that are important to us. He's in London, England today. Nice to have you back with us.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Good. I want to begin by taking a look at what most people never consider, that what's happening with our climate can directly impact the production of food, the distribution of food, the ability to maintain clean water supplies and adequate water supplies for all of our needs, because rarely do you have a situation where someone just has needs for themselves. If you have a city, you have to have it for everyone in the city, plus all the industries. And we have to look at global warming's impact upon water and water patterns on food. So could you take us through food and it's being produced, desertification around the world, especially in China, and what may end up happening between China and Russia as China's glaciers begin to melt, lessening the water coming out of the Himalayas, the fact that they have one of the fastest encroaching desert systems in the world, it's growing at an astronomical level, and also that they're running out of water and good room to grow, and yet they're the largest population now in the world. So could you take us down those paths, please?
Okay, well, first of all, you're now getting dust storms, Middle Eastern-style dust storms in Beijing. I mean, the desert's that close. Now, they're planting trees frantically in the hope of, you know, stopping the encroachment, but there's no sign that it's working so far because trees need water. Water is the flip side of food. I mean, basically, you know, what do you need to grow food? You need land, you need water, and you need sunshine. Sunshine's pretty well provided. There is a fair amount of land in the world. It's water that's the key. And the problem is that warming begins to hit the water supply very dramatically in large parts of the world. You know, overall, in a warming world, there's more evaporation because it's hotter, so there's more rain, but it isn't in the same places. And the problem is that the places that have less rain already, like the subtropics, get even less, while the places that already have enough, like the temperate zone, most of the United States, for example, get more, which they didn't need, and which could be destructive if it comes down in torrents, so that the food production gets hit. Rule of thumb, no more than that. It varies from one place to another, obviously, but on a global basis, for every degree Celsius, so say a degree and three quarters Fahrenheit, you lose 10% of global grain production. And there's no slack in the system. We don't have a reserve anymore that's worth talking about. Food production, we're still feeding everybody, with the exception of a very few unfortunates. Not well, but on the whole, we're eating better than we did 50 years ago with three times the population. But grain production stopped growing about 10 years ago worldwide. And right now, we have eaten into what used to be a 150-day global grain reserve. What's left over in the bins and the cargo ships from the last harvest when the next one comes in. Big, you know, sort of late summer in the northern hemisphere. Used to be 150 days 10 years ago. It's 57 days now. So we're already running and making up the loss with, you know, eating into the stored grain. We're not losing production to climate change yet, but we're going to. We're going to lose large chunks of production, and that's going to have huge effects. When you talk to the military, almost all of the negative effects on a geopolitical level, military level, that they foresee have to do one way or another with the fact that we're going to run out of food. Now, in China, they really get hit very hard. They have, they're not in the tropics. In fact, most of China's not even in the subtropics, but they do have a sort of a triple whammy, which makes them almost uniquely vulnerable. First thing is, the big rivers of southern and central China all come off the Tibetan Plateau, you know, way to the west. And they're fed by glaciers. The water comes out of, you know, streams that come, little tributaries that come off the glaciers and keep the Yangtze and the Huanghe and the, you know, the rivers that support paddy rice growing in southern and central China. They come off the Tibetan Plateau, and those glaciers are melting. They're going fast. Chinese Academy of Sciences itself says 7% a year. Okay, 7% a year means they're half gone in 10 years, mostly gone in 20. And then in the summer, when you need the water, it's not there, because all that keeps those rivers full in the summer, when it's not raining or snowing up in Tibet, is the melting glaciers. So rice growing in southern China is enormously hit enormously hard. Northern China grows wheat. Northern China is mostly rain-fed agriculture, but on the northeast monsoon coming in reliably every summer, and it's been getting weaker already for 10 or 15 years. I mean, in fact, last summer, the Chinese government started trying to persuade farmers in North China to stop growing wheat and grow potatoes, because they're not as thirsty a crop. However, you know, how do you persuade a billion Chinese to eat potatoes. That's not their normal diet. But that is the extent of the fear. And then the third, you know, the triple whammy, the third thing is about a third of China's food is grown in these vast river deltas, you know, where the rivers reach the sea and there's lots of flat land and you're growing a lot of food. They're very low-lying and they all face east. And that's where the cyclones, the hurricanes, so to speak, come roaring in off the Pacific. And with a little bit of sea level rise, and, you know, a very high tide when the hurricane hits the shore, you can lose those river deltas real fast, flooding all the way up to Shanghai, which is about 30 miles from the coast, and lose huge amounts of land. And once you get the salt water soaking into it, it's damaged even when the water goes back into the sea. Put all that together, and there was a study done. It's actually a contract from the World Bank. The World Bank is trying to figure out how much food everybody would lose at 2 degrees Celsius, say 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter average global temperature. So they gave contracts to think tanks in a lot of countries. The one in Beijing that did it figured out that, or said that they reckoned that at 2 degrees Celsius, 3.5 Fahrenheit, hotter average global temperature, which you can expect to see at the current rate in about 30 years, China would lose 38% of its food. Well, you know, that's revolution and civil war. No government survives that. That's people starving in the streets. So, and you know, when that happens in China, okay, they've got a lot of money, maybe they could just buy food, but no, because it's happening in a lot of other places around these subtropics and even further north at the same time. You know, Brazil's running out of food, Mexico, the farms are dried up and blown away, the whole Mediterranean is seeing crop failure after crop failure because it's all in the subtropics. Australia, Southern Africa, these places are all losing production. There's a global grain shortage. You can't buy your way out of trouble. That is why the Chinese government is really scared about climate change. More by far than the U.S. government or even European governments. They're terrified.
They are trying to make some effort now, but for 25 years, they just were focused principally upon their economic growth at anywhere from 7 to 10% per year. And also, they did not curtail. They actually encouraged a higher standard of living amongst the middle and upper middle class educated group that wanted to emulate the United States. They wanted the cars and the meat and the diet and the apartments. So they built these cities. Now,
I can't get indignant about any of that. They're just doing what we did.
I understand. I'm not criticizing them for doing it. It's just a matter of statement that if you look at the mess we have made based upon using 25% of the world's resources with now only 3%, it was 5% of the world's population, other countries are doing the same. Everybody wants to be like America, but we can't all do this. I mean, there's a finite amount of resources.
Now, that's right. I mean, you need about four planets to support everybody to U.S. scale of consumption.
So if we look at China, based upon what you've just shared, because right now, if we believe the media, we would think that China is the greatest future threat to the United States and likely to replace U.S. as the dominant economic power. However, looking at the future geopolitics, there's evidence that Russia might be in a better situated place. It has oil and gas reserves. It's up near the Arctic. It has geological surveys showing 90 billion barrels of oil. On the other hand, China faces depletion of its aquifers and its food belt, rapid desertification in its western provinces, loss of the Himalayan glacier flow, and yet China and Russia share a border, a large border. So where do you see Russia and China in terms of global dominance and in terms of stability in the next, let's say, 10 to 40 years?
10 to 40 years, I think there won't be any change in 10. But take me up to 20 or 25, and I think... Okay. Russia comes out of this much better than China. Russia's not in the subtropics. It's not, you know, it's pretty far north, most of it, although it's got a lot of good agricultural land in sort of western Russia, the Russia we're familiar with. but it's also got lots of good agricultural land in Siberia, a lot of which is not now used because it's too cold. There's not a, you know, you need about 110 frost-free days to get a wheat crop off the land, you know, and if there's a frost anywhere in that 110 days, buy wheat, goodbye wheat. Now, you know, the thing that global warming does is it extends the amount of Russia over which you've got that 110 frost-free days. And the land is there, so actually Russian food production probably actually increases very significantly. They become a very major exporter of food as the climate warms. The U.S., on the other hand, loses.
Okay.
It's a good deal further south, closer to the southern, in fact, in the subtropics. So you said Russia coming up on the food front, the U.S. going down, China collapsing. You go to Moscow, which I did not too long ago, and the Russians are absolutely paranoid about the Chinese because they can see this coming. I'm talking about Russian specialists, Russian defense people, things like that. It's not the talk of the town in the bars, you know. But when you go to the people who are supposed to know, they're all focused on, well, on two things. Will there be a conflict with the West when we start drilling for oil in the Arctic Ocean, because the ice cover's going away? It's going to be ice-free in 5 or 10 years, at least in the summer. And there are seabed boundaries between Russia and its neighbors where they think the oil is that are in dispute. So will we end up with a conflict with the West? Particularly Russia and Norway have a boundary in the sea, which is right where the oil is supposed to be. But nobody agrees where the boundary is. And NATO, you know, Norway is a NATO member. Are we going to end up in a confrontation with NATO over that, which is, you know, kind of a valuable resource, oil and gas? The other thing, a little bit longer term, is what happens when China collapses? And you have got huge numbers of Chinese refugees desperately heading for somewhere that there might be food, and you know where that is. It's north. It's Russia. Not just China, by the way. They've also got borders with Iran and Turkey, which are equally hard hit by, you know, desertification, by the loss of food production, all the rest of it. They're in the subtropics. So, you know, there's a real fear about the southern border in the longer run. But Russia ends up with enough food to feed itself and huge influence in the world there. And by then you can expect them to be back on their feet economically as well. They're getting there, finally. They're going to be a much bigger player, and I think, frankly, China, because of its internal troubles, will be a much smaller player than it expects to be in 25 or 30 years' time.
Yeah, I think that we have to be realistic. What happens when 500 million people are starving, don't have adequate food? How civil will they be? What will they do to express that concern, anger? And I believe that China has at best slow down its economic engine, start looking at its own future survival, or they're going to come up one day and see a French Revolution on their doors.
That's very likely, I think. But on the other hand, just put yourself in the shoes of the Chinese government. It's not an elected government. It's not even a very popular government. Tiananmen Square was 21 years ago, and really that was the end of popular support for communist rule in China. What keeps that government in power and keeps the population relatively quiet is that every year the living standard goes up. So the Chinese government, in interest of its own survival, cannot slow down significantly because its only credibility is delivering the economic goods, you know, the goose that lays the golden eggs. So from a political point of view, don't expect that to happen. But there's also a broader thing, which is don't expect it to happen from a psychological point of view. If you're Chinese, you have a view of history that's very different from that of the West. The history is, until about 500 years ago, this was the most powerful and technologically the most advanced country in the world. Then we got ambushed by the damn Europeans who got the jump on us with the industrial. We were almost colonized ourselves. Everyone around us was colonized. The Russians took away the whole north, and we've been living in poverty and disrespected over centuries. I mean, there was foreign troops in Beijing 110 years ago, Boxer Rebellion, all that sort of stuff. But even since then, we've been disrespected also. Now we're coming back, and we're going to be respected, and we are not going to play second fiddle, and we're not going to stay poor in the general interest. I don't see the U.S. state going poor in the general interest. So the Chinese perspective on this is, we don't make sacrifices other people aren't willing to make, even if the boat goes down and carries everybody, including us, down with it. It's a very human, not entirely rational, but very human position to find people taking. The reason that in Copenhagen last December was such a train wreck, didn't get anywhere, basically was that the Chinese weren't going to make any promises about emissions until the U.S. did, you know? And I think Obama actually thought he could go to Copenhagen with that promise in hand because he could get it through Congress. Well, it didn't happen, did it? I mean, not only did it happen in time for December, did it not happen in time for December, so he went empty-handed to Copenhagen, and the Chinese said, well, we're not doing anything either. It's now clear it's not going to happen in this administration. I mean, the Senate's not going to pass that legislation, rather unambitious though it is.
Okay, that brings me to two more points that connect. Please give us your look at where the likely food shortages will occur in the United States in the relatively near future that we should be concerned about, especially in the California Central Valley.
Yeah.
And the high plains of the Midwest.
Yes.
Because that's where most of the food in the United States, certainly the grains and vegetables, are grown.
Yeah.
And I've been out there. I was recently out there. I was recently in the San Joaquin Valley. I was in the fields. I want your perspective on this, because when I'm there talking with farmers and I'm seeing them say that they don't have water here and they can't grow there and 1,000 acres not being grown because the guy just reaches down, picks up sand or sandy soil and says, this is what we've got. If we don't have, we've over-farmed it, we don't have good water management, and no one seems to be doing anything about it. Now, that's at the ground level, out of the news, away from the think tanks and the experts. But there's two realities, the reality on the ground and the reality from a more measured perspective. Tell us about food in the United States, because I also have just finished my primary work on a documentary called the 12 Tipping Points. And by the way, I stood outside of Columbia University Graduate School in Barnard and asked over 100 graduate students and professors, how many of the 12 tipping points could you name? Well, first, 90% didn't even know there were such things called tipping points, and nobody could get more than three, and only one person got three. That's at a graduate school, a prestigious Ivy League graduate school, Columbia University and Barnard College. Now, I'm looking at 16 states in the United States that do not have now regular water in order to supply them with all their needs 12 months a year, that there are going to be worse water shortages in the future. And these are some of the most popular and populated states and cities, like Phoenix. It's going to be a ghost town. And yet you have more people going to Phoenix as if no one's letting them know, or they're choosing not to find out. You're not going to be able to live there. And yet this is at a time when they open up the largest water theme park in the United States in Phoenix.
In Phoenix.
It's just insane.
So
your thoughts on this,
please. I mean, it's really cool. What happens in the United States is that some areas get very hard hit. Other areas are probably okay. The high plains, the agricultural area west of the Mississippi River, gets hit very hard. The forecasts are for a halving of rainfall or somewhere around there. And alas, this is going to happen at about the same time that the huge Ogallala Aquifer, which underlies that whole area,
Kansas,
runs out of water, or at least large parts of it do. So you're going to lose a lot of the farming, maybe most of the farming, west of the Mississippi and the High Plains. Actually, if you just get in a plane and fly east from Denver, you can see what's happening, because they pumped the aquifer dry, and you've got all these brown circles on the ground where there used to be, you know, center pivot irrigation, farmers are growing crops. There's a little bit further east from Denver, it's going. The Central Valley of California, as you say, they're short of water now. The problem is partly poor water management, but it will be worse than that, because what really sustains the Central Valley, and that's somewhere around a third of all U.S. fruit and vegetables is grown in the Central Valley. And that is sustained. It's a relatively dry area. It was not obvious farmland, and then the big irrigation schemes went in, and what they depend on is the fact that the snow builds up in the Sierra Nevada mountains every winter, and then it melts in the spring and the summer, and it provides a constant flow of water out of the mountains when you need it. Well, let it be 2 degrees Celsius, 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, and what happens is that that snow doesn't snow. It falls as rain in the winter. It runs off straight away, and there's nothing to melt in the summer, so no water in the rivers in the summer. And goodbye, Central Valley. Stephen Chu, the energy secretary, who's a Californian himself, said something which really cabinet members should not say. He said, basically, I don't see how you sustain agriculture in California or the cities. You know, you guys... there's 35 million people living there, and only the northern half of the state has enough water for anybody to survive off of northern of you know local resources. If the big Southern California and southwestern cities, Phoenix and places like that, are to survive, they will do so by importing water, probably from Canada. There is no other long term. So there's no water in the river systems there they can access. They're using everything already. The population continues to grow. There's people in the southwestern United States living in places that there is no local water to support them.
You realize it's that's also including. You realize we're also talking about eastern Alabama,
yep.
Georgia.
Yep.
We're also talking about South Carolina.
Yep.
Those are going to be hit, and northern and central Florida.
Absolutely. I mean, they're going to get hit several ways. I mean, Alabama and Georgia are actually suffering periodic droughts already that they're unlike anything they've had in the past. Because they are technically in the subtropics.
Yeah.
Which is where the rain fails.
And
I mean, moderated greatly by the fact that you got the Gulf, the Mexico to the south and the Atlantic Ocean to the east, which sort of helps because it's sort of local rainfall. But, you know, Atlanta was actually rationing water about a year ago. Now, what happens in addition, of course, have huge exposure to storms, hurricanes and other storms. I was in Miami last week, actually, and I was talking to a guy who works for Dade County, and basically he said, look, you know, we've got a little bit of protection for the coast, but we're doing nothing serious. That's an east facing coast. The southern half of Florida is more than 10 feet above water, right? And now we have the probability of sea level rise, maybe, you know, maybe just a foot or so in the next 20, 30 years, probably no more than The estimates now are running up to 4 or 5 feet this century. Okay, so give us a foot and a half, 2 feet. But, you know, if that hurricane hits that coast at the wrong time, which is when it's high tide, and pushes that water inland, it's goodbye Miami, goodbye Fort Lauderdale, goodbye Palm Beach. And that land is permanently ruined for agriculture. And a lot of people are on the upper. I mean, it's New Orleans times 10.
Well,
Katrina times 10. So what are they doing about it? And the answer is
nothing.
Not much.
And nothing.
I was in the Netherlands recently, where they say face an even more serious problem. 30% of the country is below sea level, behind its dikes. There, they are spending $2 billion, $3 billion a year on what they call beach enrichment, which is to say, they're dredging sand up from way offshore and they're putting it off, between the dikes and the sea to make sure that no big waves hit those dikes and break through. There aren't dikes in Florida, and attempt at beach enrichment enhancement to, you know, sort of stop the worst effects of storms coming in off the ocean. It's, and, you know, you can take it all the way up the East Coast. I mean, there are three or four big bays, like Chesapeake Bay, which basically are wide at the mouth, face more or less southeast, and then narrow as they get to the top, and you get to Philadelphia or Baltimore or Washington, right? And again, you know, if this was the Netherlands we were talking about, not the United States, they'd be building dams across, or dikes across the mouth of Chesapeake Bay right now, and enhancing beaches out beyond that to give it protection, you know, a lock for ships to go through. They're not doing any of that stuff. So storms will come roaring in off the Atlantic. The sea level's a bit higher. It's at the wrong time, high tide. Downtown Washington's underwater. Manhattan's underwater. Nothing has
been
done.
Okay, final issue I'm concerned with. Yesterday on Fox, they had a former director of the CIA give his personal opinion that war with Iran was inevitable because of how Iran's trying to play the deterrent role. Now, I would like for you to give us your best guesstimate of what the likely outcome of that war would be and how it would impact the average American, how they're going to lead up to that war, which is already starting, much like they did with the weapons of mass destruction hidden in Iraq, and all the statements they were making, getting all their generals and people on television. I can see it now happening. What's the likely outcome if we have this war with Iran?
Well, I mean, it's the old saying, right? Fool me once, shame on you, shame on me. Here we go again, same propaganda, absolutely the same format. You know, they're monsters, they're coming to get us, they're going to have weapons of mass destruction, we must preempt, we must invade. I can tell you one thing. Nobody, shamefully, except one Marine general, resigned from the Pentagon over the decision to invade Iraq. And possibly the reason is that although invading Iraq was stupid and illegal and bound to end in tears, it was never going to be a military defeat for the United States. I mean, you know, Iraq was broken already. Its army had been destroyed in the first Gulf War in the 90s, never replaced and rebuilt. This is a walkover militarily, you know, although, as they failed to foresee, the next 6 years of guerrilla war is not going to be fun. In the case of Iran, it's different. Iraq was 30 million people, busted flat, no armed forces left, and a relatively easy country to invade. It's all flat, at least at the far north, and, you know, freeways running up there. Why not? Iran is 80 million people, and it's mostly mountains, and its armed forces aren't busted flat. And it is simply inconceivable that the U.S. Army could come up with the numbers of troops that would be required for the occupation of any significant part of Iran. And the general staff know that. The general staff, I should say the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is what Americans call them, but it's the same traditional general staff function. The Joint Chiefs of Staff have war-gamed wars against Iran since the early 90s. And they have never managed to make the game end in a U.S. victory. It's just not on. Because if you can't invade the place, okay, you bomb it, you know, which really annoys them, willing to fight for their country, even if they don't like the regime, but you can't invade it. And what can they do back to you? And the answer is they can shut down the whole Gulf. All they have to do is to, and they've gotten weapons, they've got these, what they call sea-skimming missiles, you know, subsonic or supersonic, fly 10, 20 feet above the water, ship-killing missiles. You can mount them on the back of a truck, drive them down any dirt track to the coast, and there's about 1,000 miles of coastline there, and fire them at the tankers going past, which are, you know, the size, the broad as the side of a barn. It's very hard to miss them. And there's very few countermeasures that you can usefully use unless you actually happen to have, you know, an Aegis missile cruiser right next to that particular tanker. Okay, so five tankers, 10 tankers sunk. What happens? Insurance rates for tankers going to the up to, you know, like 15% of the entire value of the ship and cargo, nobody's sending tankers into the Gulf anymore. And that's all Iran has to do. And, you know, after 4 or 5 weeks of that, with no oil coming out of Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, or Iran, because they'll stop their exports, of course, the world basically, you know, shudders to a halt industrially, and the pressure on the U.S. government, both domestic and foreign, to stop this nonsense becomes absolutely impossible to withstand. And, the, you know, we find some way to save American face and get them out of this mess, but that's the way the war ends. That's the way it ends every time that the Pentagon war games it.
But what happens if you have Israel that it unilaterally decides in its own interest, right
or
wrong,
Israel would never attack Iran unless it assumed it could drag the United States into the war. What would be the point? I mean, what Israel really wants is regime change. Remember that phrase?
Yes.
Yeah. What Israel wants is regime change in Iran. Now, you have to be pretty ignorant about Iran to imagine that attacking it from outside will bring about regime change. But then there's lots of people in Israel who are pretty ignorant about Iran or who are so ideologically programmed that whatever knowledge they have, they're capable of ignoring. So Israel would love to see the Iranian regime overthrown. Israel has a very limited capability to attack Iran from the air itself, enough to be a nuisance. But it would not do it if it didn't count on being able to drag the U.S. into the war. So, you know, it's not just Israel, it's the U.S.
Okay.
Or, you know, does this tail go on wagging the dog? I don't know, but it's been pretty successful for a long time.
Well, let's just see what would happen to all those neocons who are all over Washington in the think tanks if there was a war, and they're high-fiving, boy, we did this to them, and then suddenly that scenario outline comes about, and then the oil stops coming out of the Gulf, and then the insurgencies or the marauders from Iran, of which there are a lot, over 1 million men under arms, and they're trained in guerrilla warfare. They're not going to go out and fight a conventional war. They start to go into Saudi Arabia to sabotage their oil tanks or oil refineries. They could play a big mess out there. And then what do you think is going to happen to our stock market? What do you think is going to happen to the price of a flight on an airplane, to drive a car, to power grids that wouldn't have the oil? All the things that we rely upon every day, what's going to happen to that? And then who's going to hold any of these people accountable for having done the same thing twice to us?
Well, that's how I started, wasn't it? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Yeah. If we allow ourselves to be suckered by this stuff again, our own worst enemies, and we deserve everything that happens to us. And if you didn't like the recession we're just coming out of, you really won't like what happens as a consequence of an Iran and U.S. war.
Well, I thank you very much for your good work, and especially the new book that you have out, which gives us a real insight, Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats, your previous book on war. Gwen Dyer, thank you very much, and I look forward to our next conversation.
I do too, Gary.
Take care. Bye.
You too. Bye.
I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with commentary and then health and nutrition information, and then we'll take some calls. Please stay with us. Have you all with us, David Michael Green on Regressive Anecdote. We're going to talk for a moment, and then this commentary, I believe, is very important. I'll be doing more and more commentaries from myself and other individuals because I believe that we need to think deeper. We have to challenge ourselves, and those who are in positions of power, I don't believe that we're doing that at all. A few of the people, and only a few of the people, who have the intellectual capacity to do good commentaries, including Keith Urban, who's done some of the best commentaries. But those were principally and primarily done challenging various aspects of the Bush administration. I would like to see hope that Oberman would do commentaries challenging the war in Afghanistan, challenging the neocons who want to get us back into a war in with Israel on our side against Iran. So I haven't heard those, and I'd like to hear those. The truth is that American political discourse in our time has been dumbed down, cheapened, emasculated, and impoverished. It is Exhibit A in the case arguing that if America was ever once a great country, and we were, it is not now. We are instead today a crouched and fearful giant. We don't lead in the world, other than lead the regressive opposition, along with countries like Somalia and Libya, to virtually every form of international law and morality. We break all the laws, and we don't care. At home, we have two political factions. I'm against both because I think they're both serving one interest. Those who emphatically and aggressively seek to turn the clock back on every form of progress achieved in the last four decades, centuries, even millennia, and those who sheepishly and timidly defend the status quo, or perhaps favor regressing a bit more slowly. You can see this clearly in the contrast between take-no-prisoner presidents like Reagan and Little Bush versus the hopelessly between take-no-prisoner presidents of cowardliness like Clinton and Obama. You can see it on the Supreme Court. The regressive faction is bold and aggressive. The others on the court are milquetoast moderates, merely trying to hold the line on existing policy. And despite all the nonsense about balance and fairness and yada-dada, neither Bill Clinton nor Barack Obama would dare nominate a true progressive or Warren Court-style individual to the bench. Given the court, even a single liberal is impossible up against the five reactionaries. No wonder our politics are so bereft of stirring moral rhetoric. We are consumed with the smallest politics of the most narrow self-interest. Our electorate hasn't had a generous tendency in ages, and our political class is populated by careerists. That's on a good day. Elena Kagan is a good example of a bad choice. So is Barack Obama, or John Edwards, or Harry Reid, or Dick Ephardt, now a leading lobbyist, and so many others. I don't even bother to mention figures from the right, including those like John McCain, once dolled up by the media in his own campaign. Rhetoric is some sort of patriot who places country before self. He's never placed anything before self. Look across the political landscape and see if you can spot me a Daniel Ellsberg or Paul Wellstone or even a Lyndon Johnson. Yes, Lyndon Johnson. Liar? Yes. Got us into and kept us in Vietnam at his undoing, but he still had some big programs that helped a lot of people. Somebody, tell me anybody, even with the enormous flaws in the latter case, takes a principled stand on any great issue of our time and who is willing to risk something of personal value to do so. Name me the politician. Even Dennis Kucinich. Do you remember that when he was invited on Air Force One and he came back and sheepishly and coyly had to say, well, you know, he did it for principle? No, he didn't. Principle was you hold the line. Even when you lose with principle. So there are no principled people. It's as rare today as the Catholic Church doing the right thing about pedophilia. Oh, and that's not going to happen, and never has. What's perhaps most astonishing about all this is we live in a moment where even self-interest could simultaneously be both the right thing to pursue and politically popular. Even if politicians can't transcend their own bloated cravings for money and power and attention to stand up for repressed gays or shrinking glaciers, couldn't they find it within themselves to look out for the interests of tens of millions of Americans who just happen also to be voters, suffering under tremendous economic anxiety and worse? What the hell's wrong with President Barack Obama, as a politician and as a person, that he doesn't savagely excoriate the sickening monsters of the GOP who oppose extending unemployment rights to so-called lazy Americans? Yeah, lazy unless you're one of those unemployed, so you say, from your perched and protected position. But be that so-called lazy American who's having to feed a family and needs to be considered on a humane level. Well, the Republicans don't seem to have a heart for anything humane. And they're living at the edge of survival. And they're thereby along the way also learned some much-needed moral and political credit for doing so. This week saw the Shirley Sherrod case, in which regressive hitman Andrew Breitbart blasted across the media doctored-up video of a speech the black former director of the Agriculture Department's Georgia State office gave decades ago, talking about how she transcended her own impulses to discriminate on the basis of race. Transcend, I say again. But that was the part that got edited out. It was as if you lost your job because you said publicly, "I'm not a terrorist," but some right-wing freak whose parents evidently neglected them or didn't get enough breastfeeding, took the third word of the sentence and gave the rest to your boss and wife and kids and everyone else, and now you're lost in your marriage and your family and your home and your job, and no one will talk to you anymore because you said you supported terrorism. No, you're against terrorism. That's what editing does. All because maybe you voted Democratic or something. What this illustrates for the umpteenth time, Brothers Riot or what Saxby Chamberlain did to Vietnam vet Max Cleland, or the character assassination of the Swiftboat thugs didn't make this crystal clear already, is that the scum that is today the American right will absolutely say and do anything in order to score political points, while so-called progressive Democrats and liberals say and do nothing even to stop their crimes, let alone to advance a positive agenda. They do nothing, that is, unless crumpling up like frightened kittens in a thunderstorm counts as doing something. The distance traveled from Lyndon Johnson and Martin Luther King, or even a flawed John F. Kennedy, and yes, he was flawed, to Barack Obama represents a stunning collapse of empire. Once a powerful country that could, with partial justification, boast of leadership in the moral sphere, we have today shrunken, literally and figuratively, to a nation of newts looking for some kind of cheap Rush Limbaugh. For better, and unfortunately sometimes for worse, this is a country that used to have big aspirations. Now we're like a two-bit drunken banana republic, thrashing about in the gutter of history as we implode from the toxic combination of greed, stupidity, indolence, and hubris. We once used to conduct a war on poverty. Now we just incarcerate the impoverished, in privately owned for-profit jails, no less. We once used to take care of our aged and elderly. We cared about growing old. Now our big social programs legislation does little more than redirect huge masses of taxpayer funds to corporations. We once cared about promoting equality. Now when Oliver Stone makes the movie Wall Street in order to offer a cautionary tale about the perils of greed, 100,000 new stockbroking careers open up, launched instead in proud emulation of Gordon Gekko. We used to seriously care about protecting the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the land we live on from the ravages of pollution. Now we stand by and watch with our hands in our pockets as we toast an entire planet to a lethal crisp. We once used to explore the boundaries of what civil liberties could be sustained in sprawling industrialized democracy. Now we race to legislate them away as fast as we can while the state ignores guaranteed protections of privacy or due process whenever it wants to know. We once used to race to the moon, pushing ourselves to do the impossible. Now we just stick dynastic disasters of DNA dice like George Bush before podium to haplessly call for a yawn-inducing focus group scripted mission to Mars. We once used to care about how we were perceived internationally, even as we nevertheless too often display the belligerence of power. Now we don't even bother with the former while we've raised the ladder to a high art. We once used to come together as a whole country to address threats and shared national concerns, all of us making enormous sacrifices toward a common purpose. Today, our presidents encourage us to go shopping. Is it any wonder that our political rhetoric is so uninspired today? It's the perfect representation of our impoverished and moral spirit, and it's likely to bite us hard in the not-too-distant future, if it's not doing so already. It's been nearly a half a century since JFK so aptly reminded us, quote, those who do nothing are inviting shame as well as violence. Those who act boldly are recognizing right as well as reality. And yet we remain well ensconced in the first category. Gary Nall from David Michael Green, back in a moment. I'm Gary Nall. We're in studio in New York City, and we have Kara Lee in studio, and we have Bill Thompson in studio. Let's say hello to Kara Lee first. Hi, Kara Lee.
Hey, Gary. Good afternoon. I just had a quick email that I wanted to read you. A very nice thought from a recently retired professor living in Washington, D.C. He said that he never listened to your show until about a year ago. His friend had a health condition and recommended listening to your show. But once he started listening, he found out that what he really enjoyed and tuned back in for was the commentaries and the politics that he found the most interesting, because that's what his background was in. After looking at your website, he found out that you had about 500 articles and over 300 major investigative reports and 40 documentaries. And you are reporting the most investigative and original news that's out there, especially on the radio. And even though he's a conservative, he is in alignment with a lot of your ideas because they make sense and they're reasonable. He said that last weekend, he just wanted to let you know, he was on a boat excursion with some friends. All of them were political or academic backgrounds, and they started talking about the economy and politics and the war in Iraq, and he said that pretty much virtually everyone said that they listened to your show. So you may not realize the impact that you have on a lot of policymakers, but they're out there discussing and sharing your ideas. And he says sometimes they're sharing your comments without attribution. So he just wanted to let you know that you're getting the word out there and that your comments are being heard by people who are making important decisions.
That's nice. Thank you, Kara.
Sure, Gary.
Bill Thompson.
Well, good afternoon. How are you? Got a quick question for you. We're going to be setting up the fulfillment center on 92nd Street. I'm looking for carpenters familiar with building shelving to help us fill out that.
Have them give you a number.
Give me a call, please. Paying job. Give me a call, Bill Thompson, at 646-926-5439. 646-926-5439. And on a separate subject.
Okay.
What would you do with regard to jobs, the economy, environment, local and state government, and federal government spending? What do you do about that?
First, you have to be very specific and stop with broad generalizations. That's what the media does, and that's why people are confused. That's why people are also protesting. It's one thing to say that we have a problem. Everyone recognizes we have a problem, but no one's providing us with any reasonable solutions. Let me give you an example. We should have let all the Wall Street banks fail. Okay. We were lied to. We were told that if they fail, the entire economy fails. Not true, because the mainstream banks, the five largest mainstream Wall Street investment banks,
yes,
don't give a nickel to the small businesses of America, and the small businesses of America employ 80% of all Americans. They don't help the average person with loans. You can't go into Goldman Sachs and get a loan,
right,
or Merrill Lynch. These are investment houses. Now, where do they make their money? They make money off exotic bets. They're betting against a currency, actually trying to force a currency to go up or down so they can short it or they can trade in it or in a crop. They will buy and sell between them the shares in oil without ever using a gallon of oil, but you suddenly saw a gallon of oil go from $47 a barrel, I should say, to $147. That's $100 a barrel that was made in profit by them. And because we actually reduced our consumption so it wasn't supply and demand, we had less demand, more supply. The price of oil should have gone down to $27 a barrel. That's how they make their money and always have. These are people that we do not need in the United States. If you sunk Wall Street completely, and if you fired everyone on Wall Street, we would be a better nation and be stronger. You need to rely upon the 6,000 credit unions and the small savings and loan banks, of which there are over 7,000. So we have no shortages of place in order to, if you have a legitimate economic concern, you want to start a business, if you can comply with their requirements, you'll get loans. They made it seem like the only people giving loans were out of Wall Street. They lied. Henry Paulson lied. Bernanke lied. Barack Obama, pathological lie. George Bush, too stupid to know he was lying. All right? This man was any dumber, he would be a shoe. That's what we were dealing with. And it's an embarrassment. As an American, I'm embarrassed by the lack of spiritual and intellectual qualities in our leadership. I see massive Machiavellian, self-interested, mercenary individuals who will say and do anything to keep ahead and keep power because somewhere in their background they had not appreciated being given the sense that they were okay with who they are, so now they're trying to make up for it by proving who they are, and it's all bad. So, point one, and by the way, people can watch today's program. I forgot to mention that. I'm broadcasting live from our studio in New York City and back from our filming in Florida. Treat people equally. So the Federal Reserve will give to all savings and loan and the same rate of interest it gives to the major houses, zero. Therefore, any American with a good business plan should be able to bypass the corrupt and completely inefficient, completely dastardly, worthless Small Business Administration, utterly worthless, and go directly to a new small business opportunity foundation. If you can make a presentation and show that your company deserves an additional loan to grow your business, help your business, or start a new business, then it should be given a right to have an interest-free loan for 3 years. Zero interest. No payments at all. Then you repay it at 2%. That means the bank has made 200% profit. Now, the rule is for every employee, for every $1 million of that loan, up to, let's say, $5 million, you have to employ two employees. So let's say you took a $5 million loan. Now you've employed 10 Americans at about $30 an hour, which is a living wage. Now, since we have 5 million people, I'm sure, minimally, that would apply for those loans, you would employ between 15 and 25 million Americans. You would come near to removing all unemployment, and that money circulates within the local economy. You're feeding the local economy with another food store or a clothing store or a theater or a car wash, whatever it is you're doing. You're employing people and you're rejuvenating that at the local level. Secondly, let's have a special commission made up of people from all walks of life and all levels of society to start completely taking away every law and rule that we don't need, which is about 95%. You know the danger of giving people money, like kids who don't care about where it came from or how hard it was made to earn it? They don't care its value. It has no value to them.
They'll
just spend it.
Right.
Just spend it. I call it the $100 loaf of bread. Someone wants money to go to get something, and they don't bring back change. There's no such thing as change today. So you better, I spent on something. I didn't know you wanted change. Well, we have lawmakers making laws. We don't need any more laws. We didn't need a law of any essential type to control society if we just lived by the Ten Commandments.
Exactly.
So all these laws that we make, thousands of them, become tools to use for repression and suppression. We need to shrink government. Now, I'm a believer that you don't say stop spending if you're spending in the right place. We need that spending. But we also have to stop spending and creating debt where it's not helping us. So both of them are wrong on this level, meaning we should force the federal government to stop all redundancy. And right now, at least 30% of all money that goes to the federal government goes to agencies that do not do us any good and frequently are doing the same work as 10 other agencies. We just saw this from the Washington Post, that we have 1,800 different agencies, private organizations. No one's overseeing them. There's no control, and they're being given vast amounts of money to do the work of 10 other people. So we have 10 people doing the same work. This and these pork programs, these entitlement programs of legislators, I'm going to put a $200 million bridge in. But where's it going? Who does it benefit? Well, I don't care. I'm a head of a committee and I can do it. This is the corruption of Washington. Cut the federal budget by 50%. Cut the state budgets by 50% and cut the local budget by 50%. And then ask, what is needed? Well, you need education and you need health care and you need schooling. But you should renegotiate all contracts, especially the teachers' contracts. You've got to get rid of these guarantees on, you know, that we see where if we're going to suffer, let us all suffer equally. Otherwise, it's unfair. If one group gets increases every year, 4%, and everyone else is taking pay cuts, that's not democratic. And that's the corruption of many, not all, of the unions. Now, I'm a pro-union guy. I'm absolutely against how the union is manipulating the situation to its advantage when we're not all sharing the suffering equally. All right? And someone's got to stand up and say that. But they're a powerful group and they buy the vote. And that's how politicians get reelected. They go to all these power groups and say, what do you want? We want 5%. Okay, you got it. Vote for me. All right, we will. That's what's been going on for too long. So get rid of that. Cut the governments down and make them work within their budget. Just like you have to, Carrie, you have to. You can't go out and spend $20,000 a week if you're not making it.
I would love to, but
all
no.
Right. But we've got to make governments accountable, and they're not. Get them also realize the heart of recovery in the United States will be the small business person, who is not helped at all on any level, the small business person. In New York City, it's like having the mayor and everyone else come around and harass and harangue the small business person and give them nothing in return. You get nothing in return except grief in New York City. Now, I am a small business person. I am also a progressive-minded person, and I'm a spiritual person, and I care about people. I find no one in government who is willing to help the small business person. As a result, go up and down Broadway and see how many of those stores that have been there are out of business. There was a store at 89th and Broadway, 90th and Broadway, on the east side of the street. Been there for 50 years, a florist. It went out of business because it couldn't afford all the taxes and couldn't afford the increasing rent. Now there's a burger joint there. It's packed, just like we need another burger joint. So the small mom-and-pop businesses are going out of business, and we have the mauling of America. The big malls, just what we need on every block in America. Another Duane Reade, another Bank of America. We don't.
Another McDonald's.
But we're killing the small business person with too many regulations, too many taxes, overburdening them, and not giving them a break to let them expand and grow. That is like taking the heart out of a patient and playing soccer with it and wondering why the patient's dying.
Right.
So understand who are really the people who care about Americans, who are willing to put Americans to work, and who can recover this. It's the small business person. Sorry, we've run out of time. I want to thank a natural nurse with Dr. Z, who is standing by to come on. I'll be back in 2 hours, and we have a heavy-duty lineup this afternoon. You're going to hear things at the 3 o'clock show with Marilyn Hyman, directs the Pew Environmental Group's Offshore Energy Program. And we're going to talk about the decisive actions to prevent disasters like the Deepwater Horizon spill from occurring again and to ensure the restoration of the Gulf. And then tomorrow at noon, we've got Dr. Hans Kugler talking about the latest in stem cell anti-aging research. And then Tom Engelhardt, the nation's most important, one of the most important commentators on America's military adventures and the impact on our culture and economy, on Tuesday. That's tomorrow. We've got a lot to talk about. And this is the number one program in the world for truly independent and progressive minds. Democrats and Republicans need not apply. Thank you for watching.
Got to get you off of my mind. I know it's just a matter of time. You found somebody new. Our romance.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Carol Lee.
You found somebody new. Our romance is through.
Yes, it is. Some folks' love is hard and strong. That's the kind of love that lingers on. Some folks' love is swift and fast. That's the kind of love, honey, that'll never last. We had a love that was in between, and to me it was like a dream. We had a stay.